I'm sure you, like me, are watching our new administration as it takes over and wondering what it can do about these enormous problems that we face in our day. Be praying for the President and the members of Congress and the various authorities that are scheduled or trying hard to deal with these problems, because they're far beyond natural wisdom and they need God's help dealing with this humongous debt that hangs over the head of this nation. And for the very delicate dealings on a new basis with the Soviet Union these days, they need wisdom and prayer for that. Some wisdom on how to handle this vicious traffic in drugs that is destroying so many lives today. And for the mounting moral crisis that we're facing over abortion and the rise of homosexuality as an acceptable lifestyle in our nation today, the divisions in Congress and the racial strife that seems always to be with us, the violence in our city streets. As you can see, there's a tremendous, tremendous series of problems waiting to be solved. So be in prayer for that. I think also that we find a very similar situation in the case of our friend Nehemiah, who faced the problem of rebuilding the walls and gates of Jerusalem some 2,500 years ago. And yet in this ancient story, there is help for us today to know how to face the problems that our nation faces and to face the individual problems in our lives as we think of rebuilding areas of our own lives or facing weak spots and places where we're easily invaded. This is the book that will help us with that very much. The one thing that I think emerges from this book is that this problem or this life is a battle from beginning to end. Nehemiah ran into opposition the moment he began to set his heart to obey God's command to rebuild the walls and gates of Jerusalem. Before he even got to the city, he was having difficulty. And after he reached there, there were enemies who rose up to oppose everything he did. And I don't know whether you've yet experienced all of that in your Christian life, but you will, because as the text from Ephesians 6 that was read to us this morning says, we do not wrestle with flesh and blood. Men and women, other humans, are not really our problem. What we're up against is invisible forces. The world powers of darkness, Paul calls them. And you see them at work in this book of Nehemiah just as well. We are confronted by an invisible enemy who hates law and order and justice and peace, who loves to mangle and trap and destroy and murder, and who lives to oppose the work of God in creating harmony and beauty and love and respect for one another. That's what we're up against. We learn from the scriptures and also see it in action in a book like this that the devil has two main ways of working. And I hope you bear them strongly in mind, because you're going to run into both of them in your own experience, if you haven't already. First, he comes, as Peter says, like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And a lion is a very dangerous and very powerful beast. And if you're around one who is out to attack you, it results in tremendous fear. A lion is so strong that one bite from his jaws can bite through the thickest bone in the human body, the thigh bone. And one blow from his paw can smash a human skull like it was an eggshell. And this portrays the ability of the enemy to strike at us with calamity, with disaster, with frightening circumstances that chill our blood and make us very much afraid, threaten us with loss and disappointment. That's the enemy at work in our lives. Then he has another capacity. The Bible reveals that he can turn suddenly and become what the Scripture calls an angel of light. And he comes with smiling, gracious accommodation to us, and with pleasant promises and flattering words and friendly suggestions and the offer of enticing promises and goals that we can have and won't have to pay for or won't cost us anything. And this is the way the enemy gets at us as well. Now, either one, whether by fear or by flattery, will result in some destruction of our life. Ruin will begin to set in. And we have to be on our guard against each of those. That's why the Apostle Paul says of himself, we are not ignorant of the devil's devices. And Nehemiah teaches us not to be ignorant of how the devil goes to work. Now we've come in this book to the sixth chapter. And here we see, after a series of attacks that the enemies of Nehemiah faced him with, that were threats against him and created a sense of fear, of attack, and so on, that now in chapter 6 they suddenly switch tactics. And they begin to confront him, rather, not with attack, but with friendliness and with persuasion, as we see now as we read these opening words in verses 1 through 4. When word came to Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message: come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply: I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? And four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same message, the same answer. It's evident here that the enemies could not stop the work of building the wall by threat and attack, and so they switched their tactics. And you're going to experience this too. You try to correct some wrong place in your life, and you'll run into this same attack. It is possible that you, your friends will become your most dangerous foes. I find many people are failing today and faltering in their Christian pilgrimage because they listen to the advice of their friends. And you know, your friends may not be reflecting the wisdom of God. They may be picking up the attitudes and wisdom of the world around. And it sounds like good advice because so many people follow it, but it's totally wrong. And this is why we have to check everything by the word and wisdom of the Scriptures. And Nehemiah is confronted with this. Now these people suddenly become his friends, and they invite him to a conference down on the plain of Ono. If you locate that in the land of Palestine, it's down near where the airport is in Israel right now, down on the level of the seacoast, near the Gaza Strip. And as we've already seen, this was part of the home of the enemies of Nehemiah. So he's inviting Nehemiah to come down close to where his enemies are, and to discuss these matters. But Nehemiah senses a danger in this. He says, but they were scheming to harm me. Some of the commentators suggest that they were trying to trick him into leaving Jerusalem, where he had armed support, and coming down to a conference where they would set upon him and physically attack him or even kill him. But Nehemiah evidently senses this, and he resists this and is unwilling to comply. He sends them this report. He firmly declines. He says, "I'm carrying on a great project, and I cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" That's a great answer. And I think we need to especially note the reason that he gives for this. It sounds a bit surly to respond to an invitation to discuss with words like this. Sounds like he's being very brusque and blunt and cutting them off. But you see, he sees the situation much more clearly than they do. And he refuses to go along. And even though four times they pressure him, as you may experience too, continuing pressure to give up your stance and to change your mind and to go along with something that's wrong. So Nehemiah persists here in refusing to do this. And the reason why is this. "I'm doing great work," he says. "I have a great calling. God has committed a tremendous project to me. And if I leave, it will be threatened." And I think one of the most helpful things that we as Christians can do to resist temptation is to remember that God has called us to a great task. This is true of everybody, every believer in Christ. I don't care how young you are in the Lord or how old you are in the Lord, you're called to a tremendous task today. You know what it is? It's to model a different lifestyle so the people who are being ruined around you by their lifestyle will have something that offers them hope and a change and a deliverance to them. If they see in you a way to be at peace in the midst of confusion, if they see in you an invisible support that keeps you steady and firm under pressure, they're going to at least have some hope that there is another way. There is another way to live than what's destroying them on every side. And that's the great work that God has called us to do. And we ought never to give any adherence to anything less than that. I remember reading years ago of a missionary in China, a young man, very capable young man, who did a great job as a linguist and a diplomat working for the Lord out there. And his abilities were so outstanding that one of the American companies working in China tried to hire him. They offered him a very attractive job with a very attractive salary. And he turned them down. He said no, he was working there. God had sent him to China and as a missionary, and that's what he was going to do. And he thought that would end the offer, but instead they came back with an increase of salary. And he turned that down. But again they came back, and they tried to persuade him and made a very attractive offer to him and increased, in fact, doubled the salary that had originally been proposed. And finally he gave his answer to them. He said, "No," he said, "the trouble is, it's not your salary that's too small, it's the job that's too small." And I think this is something of what Nehemiah is saying here. He has a great work, and he's not going to forsake it for anything. I ran across these words from Dr. F.B. Meyer earlier in this century, a great Bible teacher. He says, "O children of the great King, let us pray that we may know the grandeur of our position before Him, the high calling with which we have been called, the vast responsibilities with which we are entrusted, the great work of cooperating with God in erecting the city of God, heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ, called to sit with Christ in the heavenly, risen, ascended, crowned in Him, sitting with Christ, far above all principality and power. How can we go down, he asks, down to the world that rejected Him, down to the level of the first Adam, from which at so great cost we have been raised, down to the quarry from which we were hewn, and the hole of the pit whence we were digged? No, it cannot be. And surely that's something of the spirit that Nehemiah displays here as he's confronted with this very attractive offer that seems to be very promising and acceptable, and yet is filled with danger. Well, now when the enemy can't accomplish his purpose by offering peace and friendliness, he switches back to his original tactic of threat and danger. And you find that here, beginning with verse 5. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aid to me with the same message, that is, to come down and confer. And in his hand was an unsealed letter, in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem, the Arab, says it's true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem: there is a king in Judah." Now this report will get back to the king, so come, let us confer together. It's obvious this is an arm-twisting tactic, isn't it? Designed to put pressure on Nehemiah to yield to their desire and fall into their trap. But he resists it because he sees it to be, for what it really was, nothing but just simply an enticement based upon lies and without any basis in fact whatsoever. Notice how that he responds to it. He says it's with just a simple denial. This is very much like anonymous letters that we sometimes receive today. I've been on the receiving end sometimes of letters that nobody will sign. They take you to task for something or complain about something that's going on, and then do not sign their name. And my practice through the years has always been to just throw them in the wastebasket. If people will not sign their name to something, there's no use paying any attention to what they have to say. This is really the work of cowards, or perhaps fools. I heard once of a man, a public speaker, who was standing on a platform, and somebody sent a note up to him, and he unfolded it, and all it had written on it was the word fool. And he said to the audience, "I've received many messages without names signed before, but this is the first time I ever received a man signing his name and no message." And perhaps that's the proper way to respond to something like this. You notice he says it was an open letter or an unsealed letter. That is, it was designed for everybody to read who was handling it in the delivering process, and thus to spread this idea abroad based fully on a made-up story that Nehemiah was trying to make himself king. And this was his reason for building the wall. Notice how he replies. "I sent him this reply: nothing like what you are saying is happening. You're just making it up out of your head." That's the way to respond. Just a flat denial. There's no attempt here to disprove it. He just publicly states that's a lie. No truth in it. And then invariably his response is one of prayer. He says, Nothing like this is happening. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. You see their tactics. They were trying to discourage Nehemiah by the people learning that he, or thinking that he had some secondary reason for this, some hidden motive for building the wall for his own glory, and thus to be discouraged and to quit the work. And Nehemiah just simply prays, Lord, don't let that happen. Stop that and strengthen me. Help me to work all the harder. It's a great response, and one that will help us, I think, if we're exposed to some kind of slanderous lies like this. Now, once again, the enemy switches his tactics back again, this time to subterfuge. In verse 10, one day I went to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. He said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night, they are coming to kill you. This comes in the form, really, of a prophecy. This man is a false prophet, actually, but he's one of these who claims to have hidden knowledge, occult knowledge, perhaps. I think that's suggested here by this word that he was shut in at his home. That doesn't mean that he was sick. It means that for some religious reason he was secluding himself. And this is frequently the case with those who claim to be seers and in touch with the invisible world. You go visit some of these palm readers and others, and you find them sitting behind curtains and in semi-darkness, and they're trying to create a sense of mystery as though they know more about life than you do or anyone else. And this is what this man is doing here. And what he says sounds logical. He says, you've got some people out to get you. They're going to kill you. And Nehemiah certainly believes that. And this man suggests, so come on down here and we'll go into the temple. They won't dare attack you there, and shut the doors and you'll be safe. Now that sounds good, doesn't it? But immediately, Nehemiah detects something wrong. Hearing that, he knows that he is not permitted to go into the temple. He was not a priest, and only the priests could enter the temple. He was a layman, and though nothing wrong with being a layman, it was simply not right for him to do this. And so he answers, but I said, should a man like me run away, or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. You see, he realizes that a prophet who was really from the Lord would say something in line with the commands of God. He would not ask him to disobey a command of God. There was an altar of asylum in the temple courtyard to which people could go who were under threat and be safe. But this man is proposing that they actually go into the temple and shut the door. So Nehemiah says, I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me, because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He'd been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. You see, it's all planned to discourage the people from following Nehemiah's lead, fueled by jealousy and by ambition from these enemies. They slandered him, and they tried to trap him and trick him into yielding to their demands. And I think we have to be very much aware of this kind of thing in our own lives these days. You know, don't take everybody's advice just because they're friendly to you. It may be wrong advice, totally wrong. This is why nothing substitutes for a knowledge of the Word of God. This is the way you test things, the way you can detect error and tell what is wrong. And the best response to it is what Nehemiah uses here. A deep sense of his own identity as a believer. Should a man like me run and hide and try to save his life by wrong approaches and wrong practices? And he falls back upon his own consciousness of who he is. Now, this is exactly what the New Testament calls us to do. You find appeals in the New Testament where the Apostle Paul, writing to the Corinthians and others who are faced with all the normal pressures and problems of life today, says to them, walk worthy of God. You're called to walk with God. You're a child of His. You belong to Him. You're living at a different level than those around you. And don't forget who you are. And if you remember who you are, you won't go along with some of these wrong things that are said and pressures upon us today. Henry David Thoreau, you remember, wrote in Walden Pond, "If I seem to not keep step with others, it's because I'm listening to another drumbeat." And that's what a Christian is to do. He's listening to another drumbeat. He's following the Lord and not the voices around. And nothing will free us more from all the subtle pressures and temptations of today than to remember who you are, that you're a believer, and that you're a child of the King. So this too then is handled by remembering that, and again by prayer. Look at verse 14. "Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah." Here's a woman who got into the act. We're not told what she did or said, but she's evidently part of the false prophets here. "And the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me." Again, Nehemiah relies upon the invisible hand of God, upon guidance from the Spirit. And nothing will help us more in our pilgrimage through life than to remember that the Word of God and the Spirit of God are given to us to guide us through all the difficulties that come our way. Are you utilizing these? You see, they're just as much available to us as they were to Nehemiah. And we can be just as successful as he was if we employ them. So we come then, in verse 15, to the end of this first phase of Nehemiah's work. "So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. And when all our enemies heard about this, and all the surrounding nations saw it, our enemies lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God." Even the enemies had to admit that God was in these people's lives. And this accounted for their success. An amazing success. This wall, this whole wall built around the entire city area, you had a map that showed you how extensive that was finished in 52 days. Nehemiah left Persia, you remember, in April. And it took him several months to journey to Jerusalem. And yet, on October 2nd, in the year 445 B.C., that's this date, the wall was finished. 52 days later, because they put their minds and their shoulders to the work. "And when our enemies heard about this, they lost their self-confidence and they realized that they were battling against God Himself." What a beautiful picture of the power of Christian witness in a community, isn't it? That even the enemies have to admit that God is at work among them. But they're still not through. And in these closing verses from 17 through 19, you see how they continue their tactics of opposition. Also, in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Ara, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. That's simply saying that Tobiah had intermarried with some of the Israelites and was related to them by marriage. And taking advantage of that position, he was seeking to undermine Nehemiah's influence by nothing more than simple gossip. That's all it was. As Nehemiah says, "Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and then telling him what I said. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me." You know, the truth that this conveys to us is that the devil never quits. He's never going to give up while we're still alive. I've been living now for some 71 years. And I have to tell you, the battle is just as intense, sometimes more so than it ever was. And I don't expect ever to stop until the Lord calls me home to glory, because that's the nature of life. God has wonderful blessings for us, and much encouragement and strength and joy and wonderful experiences along the way. But we're never going to stop battling against the world, the flesh, and the devil until we get home to glory. And this tells us to expect that. Don't expect it all to even out. Don't expect your retirement days to be without difficulty or struggle. That's what the world wants. That's their confused and distorted view of life, but it's not ours. We're exposed to this, and the enemies will never quit. If they can't undermine us with fear and with flattery, they'll try gossip, just to spread tales and rumors about us. And this is what Nehemiah shows us happened with him as well. A campaign of secret intrigue that keeps people uncertain as to what he is doing. Now in chapter 7, which is the longest chapter in the book, but we're not going to read it, so don't panic. You find the last phase of this recovery of Nehemiah. In this chapter, he seeks to establish and to perpetuate the achievements that he has brought about. And this is wise. He points successors and establishes new policies, as we'll see in these opening verses here. After the wall had been rebuilt and I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed. I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most men do. Wouldn't you men like to have something like that said of you? I said to them, "The gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot. While the gatekeepers are still on duty, have them shut the doors and bar them, and also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and some near their own houses." Just because the wall was built, Nehemiah didn't stop his precautions. He realized that they were still subject to attack. And rather than open the gates at dawn, as most of those cities did, he said, "Don't open them till the sun is hot." And thereby he precludes any possibility of a sudden surprise attack while people are still sleeping. And he points residents of the city to guard still at the points, at the vulnerable points of the city wall. And this is teaching us that we can't ever let down our guard. How many men of prominence in the Christian life have we seen fall in their later years because they let down their guard and thought everything was going to be okay, and they ceased to do battle with the enemy. Now, in verses on through the rest of this chapter, it's given over to preserving the purity of the doctrine that God had taught, the teaching that He had given to Israel, and their commitment to the cause. And what was necessary to do that was to be sure that only true Israelites lived within Jerusalem. And this is explained to us in verses 4 and 5. Now the city was large and spacious, but there were few people in it, and the houses had not yet been rebuilt. So my God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the common people for registration by families. I found the genealogical record of those who had been the first to return, and this is what I found written there. Then you get a list of all the names of the families of those that came back from Persia to Jerusalem under the leadership of Ezra before the time of Nehemiah. These, of course, were the ones who helped him build the wall. And he's not only giving credit to them, but he's also recognizing that they are the ones who will be responsible to carry on what he has begun. So having appointed leaders who would succeed him, men of integrity, men of courage, men of faithfulness, he now sees to it that the followers that they have are also true Israelites. And from verse 6 on through verse 60, you have a list of the names of families of those who had were able to prove their ancestry. Now the spiritual application of that is, we need to know that we really belong to God. You'll never be a successful servant of Christ. You'll never faithfully work for Him and serve Him until you're able to be assured that you know Him and you belong to Him. And this is not only necessary for leaders, but for the common people as well. We all need to know that. Otherwise, our service will be very weak and ineffective. In verse 61, you find some who couldn't prove their ancestry. The following, we're told, came up from the towns of Tel Melah, Tel Harsha, Kirib, Aden, and Immer. These are cities in Persia. But they could not show that their families were descended from Israel. And so they were not permitted to live in the city of Jerusalem because they had uncertain ancestry. And then he moves to the leaders. And from among the priests, verse 63, the descendants of Hobiah, Hakaz, and Barzillai, a man who had married a daughter of Barzillai the Gileadite and was called by that name, these searched for their family records, but they couldn't find them. And so they were excluded from the priesthood as unclean. And the governor therefore ordered them not to eat any of the most sacred food reserved for the priests until there should be a priest ministering with the Urim and the Thummim. I haven't time to adequately develop that last reference there to the Urim and the Thummim, but it's very clear that certain ones among the priests were excluded because they could not prove their ancestry. And once again, this speaks of those who today try to minister in the church of God who are uncertain that they belong to God themselves. I run into pastors like this at times, professors in seminary, leaders in the Christian community who cannot prove that they, who do not know themselves that they're really Christians. And these always wreak havoc among the churches. But, and so here Nehemiah takes very great care of that. This reference, by the way, to the Urim and the Thummim is interesting. If you read the Old Testament, you learn that these are two stones which the priest the high priest had on his garments, by which he could know the mind of God. Now, just how they worked, no one really knows. Their names mean lights and perfections. And in some way, you'll find it frequently in the Old Testament, they used these to determine the mind of God. Now, Nehemiah says, these suspect priests are not allowed to minister until a high priest arises who has the Urim and the Thummim. And I think this is a hidden reference to our Lord Jesus. He's said in the book of Hebrews to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek, who lives forever and who fully knows the mind of God. And he can restore a suspect priest to a place of assurance in his ministry, put him back into office. And we've seen some of that those things happen from time to time in the ministry around here. Now, the last part of the book is just a record of how many came back. And then there's an account of a great offering that was taken for the rebuilding of the walls in verses 70 through 72. And finally, how the suburbs around Jerusalem were settled. And that brings us through chapter 7. Now, I'm just, in closing, thinking back through this account and noting with you the factors that make Nehemiah able to stand against the pressures and temptations of his day. And these are the same factors that will enable us to stand today. Here they are. First, there's a great awareness of the greatness of his task. That God had given him a job to do, a ministry to perform, a lifestyle to emulate and to model for others. And he never forgot that. Never forgot that God had sent him into that area to teach people how to live and to demonstrate it in his own life. That held him when there were pressures against him. Then second, he never forgot his own identity. He knew who he was. He knew God had called him. He knew he belonged to him, that he was part of God's people. And he never forgot that, or allowed himself to. And third, he was free from the influence of others. He just didn't listen to everything that came along. He didn't take advice from those who he was not conscious of had access to the mind and wisdom of God. But he set it aside and refused to listen to voices that did not accord with that. And then he was careful to put into practice what he knew in a very common sense way. The practicality of this man. He applies these things in very obvious and practical ways. He guards the gates. He sets up guards. He assigns responsibilities. He shares the labor and assigns the work and so on. He judges and carefully works through things in a very practical manner. And that's a great technique. And then above all else, he prays. Everything is subjected to the wisdom of God. I think one of the most helpful scriptures that have guided me through my life that I learned as a young man by heart, found in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. It says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths." You want God directing your life? Well, then begin to do those simple things. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not to your own understanding of life, but in every way test according to the Scriptures. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your path. I'd like to conclude this service by having us stand and sing another verse or two. I think the first two verses of number 478 again. "Soldiers of Christ, arise and put your armor on."
Thank you, Pastor Ray.
Mm-hmm.
verses 1 and 2.